Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to another Empire Podcast Preview Special. We do these every now and again when a TV show comes along. Take that pilot. That's right up our geeky street. And lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, there's one this very week, as Thursday, August 29th, sees the long-awaited return of Prime Video's epic The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Based, of course, on the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien, this show tells the story of how the One Ring and all its cousins came to be thousands of years before the events of The Lord of the Rings. Season 1 ended with quite the shock as the character Halbrand, played by Charlie Vickers, was revealed as none other than the Dark Lord Sauron. Keep an eye on him. Because he's up to no good this time around as the forces of darkness begin to put plans into place. Plans that the likes of Galadriel and Elrond will doubtless wish to thwart. The second season runs for 8 episodes, the first 3 of which drop on Thursday before resuming a weekly cycle. And in this preview special, you're going to hear from Galadriel herself, Morfydd Clark, and new cast member Sam Hazeldine, who plays the orc known as Adar. But first, we're going to hear from the real power behind the Rings of Power showrunners, J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay, who spoke to our John Nugent, DTN, about what you can expect from the second season. Enjoy.
J.D. Payne, Patrick McKay, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you both?
Good. Thanks, John. Good to be here.
It is, as we speak, the morning of the premiere, season 2, Rings of Power. How can I get a sense of how you were feeling when you woke up this morning? Like, were nerves, excitement?
We're both parents, so we have young kids. Okay. Our kids weren't sleeping last night, so both of us, I was rocking my one-year-old for 2 hours trying to get her to fall asleep. Okay. Patrick was in silver crazy straights. And
no, I think we were both waking up. I was counting how many hours of sleep I got. Is it enough to get through the 15-hour marathon that is today?
Yes. But then you say, oh my gosh, this is 4 years of work, not only from us, but from thousands and thousands of our collaborators that is not going to see the light of day. And we're so excited.
Yeah.
We're really, really proud of this season. We're so proud of the work that every one of these amazing actors does. The performances are so great. Filmmaking is so strong this season. And that's not us complimenting ourselves. That's us complimenting Charlotte Branstrom, our amazing producing director, and her DP, Alex Dizanoff, who's, you know, I mean, like a young Gordon Willis or something. You know, we're just so excited for people to actually finally see it. And we hope people, you know, see all the love and care that went into it. Mm.
Yeah, so season 1, I guess, was like reintroducing people to this world, bringing us back to Middle Earth. What is your like driving mission, I suppose, with season 2? Like, what do you want people to feel at the end of this run?
Well, it's all about Sauron this season, and you know, and specifically his relationship with Celebrimbor. He's going to be seducing, manipulating, and ultimately gaslighting Celebrimbor. And you know, the scary thing about Sauron is that other villains might sort of look for your weaknesses and figure out how to exploit those. Sauron sees your strengths. And so I suppose, you know, one thing that you might want people to feel or take away is, you know, how that happens in our own lives. You know, where are our own strengths potentially becoming weaknesses if they're being used for ends that, you know, aren't the ends that, you know, we would hope to be used for. So it's a season of watching the subtle ways in which evil gets to us.
But it's also a descent. You know, season 1, we really wanted it to be a big, bold, and beautiful, you know, new journey to Middle Earth. And then towards the end of that season, things start taking a turn into the shadows, and this season dwells there. And, you know, I think just as viewers, we feel when we watch the episodes, which we've watched more times than we could stand anymore at this point, you know, that there's this undertow to the season that's pulling you forward, and a momentum to it that it gains as it goes along. And we really hope people are pulled along for that ride.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess it's different from the first season in that no one really knew what to expect with season 1, right? And now we have certain expectations. We know these characters a little bit more. I mean, is that a blessing and a curse to have the audience coming in not as blind as they were?
Well, I would say one of the things we admire about, you know, so many of these, you know, hugely ambitious, serialized shows the last 20, 25 years, is that, you know, each season can have its own character. Mm-hmm. We almost like to think of every season of this show as being like, you know, the different color spine of a book that might, you know, on your shelf, they all add up to one series, but they're all a little different. They all have their own flavor. Mm-hmm. And even though there may be expectations from season 1 of what this is, I hope we fulfill, but also subvert them season two is quite different from season one. Like season two is, you know, this huge ensemble cast with all of these worlds. We love Numenor. We love the world of the halflings, the dwarves. But if season one had a protagonist, it was probably Galadriel. Season two's protagonist is a villain, and that's Sauron. And that means that kind of everything's going to be through a different prism. And that means it's going to be maybe darker even than people anticipate, maybe even darker than we anticipated. And that makes for a different type of storytelling. Dare say future seasons will be different as well. So we hope people, you know, recognize and appreciate that, like, you know, they're not going to get the same thing they got last time, but hopefully they got everything they liked and maybe some new things they weren't expecting.
Yeah. That's so interesting that you consider Sauron the protagonist. Are we almost going to be invited to root for him? Because that seems...
I mean, the title of the series is Rings of Power. And yeah, without Sauron, there would be no Rings of Power. Yes. So in a strange way...
Well, he's the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so in a strange way, you know, though you don't want him to win in terms of dominating the world, you need him as an adversary to be able to be mixing things up so that your heroes have the adventure to be able to go on. To be able to grow and become what they need to become. Mm-hmm. There's no story without an antagonist. But so in terms of him being a protagonist, I think it's because his goal is to create the rings, and that's what we're watching happen this season.
Yeah.
There's something really interesting that happens to audiences when they're watching a villain try to enact their plans. You crave for them to succeed because you crave drama.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
A more eloquent version of what I was trying to say.
But at the same time, you're also protective and worried about your heroes. Mm. And so that push and pull can make for a very complicated and subversive viewing experience. And I think, you know, there are places this season where you're going to feel that. You're going to feel taken in by Sauron. You're going to weirdly want him to pull off his plan, also be horrified when the results are put before you.
Yeah. We saw a little bit of that in season one, but I guess we'll see a bit more of it this season, is that you sort of present Sauron in some ways as being quite reasonable, right? Like he, and he's very earnest in his goals. It's just his goals happen to be incredibly evil.
Well, he's the hero of his own story, but right. You know, I would reserve judgment on you know Sauron until the season plays out.
Okay. And in terms of his goals, and this is a classic Tolkienian thing, you know, ends versus means is important for Tolkien. You know, Sauron has pretty good ends. You know, he wants to heal and rehabilitate Middle Earth. He's got a vision for this, you know, beautiful, peaceful, wonderful society. But to do that, he's going to control the wills of everyone in Middle Earth. So it's the means that he's using to get to the ends that ultimately corrupts the entire project.
Mm. Yeah. And obviously, you know, Sauron, as we know, is a schemer and he's always strategizing. What does that mean for you as writers to get into his head? You have to be also scheming and strategizing, right?
Well, very interesting question. You know, so part of the, you know, narrative architecture of season two is that Sauron has a plan. The audience is pretty sure they know what it is. He's going to want to make some rings and somehow that'll let him conquer the world. And, you know, Adar is his enemy. We set them up as adversaries from the very beginning. We talk about them as the two snakes in a basket. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it seems like he wants revenge against him and he wants to take him out, and you know, he wants Mordor and to claim all those armies there. But how exactly he's going to pull that off is something we like to keep a little ambiguous. And so you're always, you know, one step ahead of some characters and maybe half a step behind Sauron. Mm-hmm. And the tension of that, you know, means that we need to know, you know, everything Sauron's going to do at the end at the beginning. Yeah. And then, you know, hopefully when the season ends, you look back and you see every single domino he was laying, even as some of them you didn't even notice.
But it can be an uncomfortable thing to get inside the mind of someone so evil.
I imagine,
C.S. Lewis, contemporary of Tolkien's, wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters, where it's all about the desire to, it's two devils writing to each other about how to destroy a man's soul. And they're wonderful letters. And people ask him, you know, why don't you keep writing more of Screwtape Letters? He said, I could have written it forever. Once you sort of can get into that headspace, you can keep going. But like trying to be in the headspace of someone who wants to destroy the soul of another human being is a very uncomfortable place to be. Yeah. And I think writing Sauron can be a very similar experience because, you know, there is something so sick and twisted about how he views other people and about how he views himself that trying to put yourself in a place where people are just sort of objects to be moved around your chessboard and completely expendable. And, you know, you can be totally friendly to them and have all sort of outward graces. But then you would just as quickly, you know, shove them off of the battlements somewhere or you know, stick a knife in their back and have no remorse for it.
Mm. Yeah. And also, obviously, last season's the big reveal was that Halbrand was Sauron. You don't have that mystery going into this season. Is that a challenge for you creating drama and mystery for the audience?
No, in some ways it's a relief. You know, we envisioned this whole show from the beginning as this, you know, 50-hour mega epic, we call it. And we very much, you know, designed what stories each season would be so that they complemented and spoke to one another. Season one was the one time that Sauron could deceive the audience the way he deceives characters in multiple, you know, storylines yet to come. That meant an enormous amount of discipline, which was to keep the Jack in the Box all of season one. And we knew that, you know, in doing that, it would create an enormous opportunity for season two to level up, hopefully, in terms of villainy and excitement. You know, I think we like to think that, you know, season one, you know, you can say that it all built to one twist. There's some kind of a twist every single episode in season two.
But it's also not something that we chase as storytellers. You know, we're not sort of all about, you know, the big reveal that no one saw coming. Right. You know, that's a tool that we, you know, use when appropriate and enjoy deploying. But, you know, there are tons of other tools that we enjoy using.
No, I mean, we actually worked really hard to make it, in our minds, totally obvious that he was Sauron from the very first shot you see him in.
Yeah.
And people who were like, I think that's that. Well, great. That's a version of watching season one. And, you know, hopefully, you know, when you watch the first 20 minutes of season two, which, you know, lets you inside his head and shows you where he's come from, what he's suffered and endured, you know, it almost makes you like watch season one again through his eyes. And, you know, hopefully all those scenes sort of have a whole new lens on them now.
Mm. Yeah. You mentioned that learning a bit more about Sauron. You know, this season we learn a bit about his background, which I think is not something we've seen on screen before. You know, he's always been quite a mysterious villain. Is it fun to, like, do you feel like you understand him more now?
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, we had a conception of his character that it's, you know, deeply based in a close reading of the books, you know, from the very beginning, that, you know, it's all about his eye. He sees you. He sees who you are. He sees your good qualities, and he has the cunning to know how to turn them to his own ends. And that, as the sort of, you know, central driving ethos of his characterization, you know, very much played out all over season one. But now season two, as you're sort of watching the whole world through his eyes in a way, I think that becomes more dimensional and complex. You know, Sauron sees himself not just as the hero of his own story, but he sees himself as the victim. Mm-hmm. I've been betrayed. I've been put upon. You know, he has a martyrdom complex. He's quite complex, and I wouldn't trust him.
and very uncomfortable to spend time with him. I'd say if I had to sit my psychiatrist chair and diagnose him, I'd say he's probably borderline personality disorder with sociopathic tendencies.
And narcissist.
Extremely
yes. vain.
Yeah.
To say the least. Yeah.
But, you know, and I think a lot of us have probably brushed, you know, elbows with, you know, people like that before in our various lives and romantic lives or in our colleagues. And it's hard to be with, you know, someone who, like Sauron, can turn himself into a victim in a moment's notice, you know, and then bludgeon you over the head the next moment and, in, you know, use you for his own ends. I mean, he's a really scary character, and his mind is not a pleasant place to spend time.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, all of this, we're talking about, you know, conception and writing and, you know, source text and mythology, and, you know, that all kind of goes away when an actor steps in front of the camera. Charlie Vickers gives an extraordinary performance this season. We can say that because it's not ours, it's his, and we're just lucky to be on the ride with him. All of those layers and all of that dimension and all of that self-regard and self-deception, you know, he has built into this character from, you know, way back deep into season one, and now it's really paying off in spades. Watch his performance. It's really extraordinary what he's doing. Mm.
I mean, you could also almost say performances, right? Like he's there's
yes,
layers
the
and modulations.
Sauron has a fixed center,
yeah.
But he is also playing other characters where you see aspects of that character. It's quite complex. And we should talk about Charles Edwards as well, who is his partner in the two-hander kind of at the core of the season. He plays the Elven da Vinci Celebrimbor. And Charles Edwards' performance is similarly nuanced and stunning. And, you know, you feel his ambition and his vanity and, you know, but also his deep tenderness and vulnerability and sweetness. Mm-hmm. And it's really heartbreaking where that story goes.
Yeah. And also, I don't want to give anything away to anyone who is listening who hasn't seen, but there are other people playing Sauron as well. How do you you know, keep a sort of consistency among your Saurons?
Well, Sauron is someone who can shapeshift in a certain way to suit his own needs. And so, you know, I feel like it makes sense to see him wearing various masks, so to speak, and you see him as a disembodied puddle creature at a certain yes. point.
You see an earlier iteration of a fair form Sauron.
Mm. Then you see him as Halbrand. Then you see him as Sauron. Then you see him as Annatar. So you know, one
multifaceted.
Thing we, yeah, one thing we reckon about villains and antagonists is that if they keep on changing form, you know, they keep on sort of guessing you. They keep you guessing as to which form they're going to appear in next.
Yeah. It's very fun. It's very fun to see that journey. The other thing that's different this season as well, like the end of last season, the rings were forged, the first rings, at least the three elven rings. How does that change the sort of the balance of storytelling? Because you're introducing a new form of magic, right?
It changes everything.
Yeah.
We like to say that this is like the dawn of the nuclear age, where this new power has come into Middle Earth and no one knows what it's going to do. And that lack of knowledge is actually where some of the drama of season two lives. These rings are brought back to the elves and they're discovering it in real time. And there's two very strong points of view about what they could be. Elrond feels like Sauron influenced their design. Galadriel says he never touched them. But Elrond feels like even having just a hand in how they were made, what if he built a back door in that could somehow be used to control us or spy on us or destroy us? Galadriel, on the other hand, sees that the rings are necessary for the continued survival of the elven people. We love it when protagonists can both be right and both be on opposite ends of a difficult conversation. It's a great place for drama to go.
Yeah. Yeah, the nuclear thing is that's such an interesting comparison because they are like incredibly powerful in both a positive and negative way, right?
Well, they change everybody who is, responsible for taking care of them, right? Yeah. Anybody who carries a ring, it's going to affect them in ways that maybe they're not expecting. Any society that's in possession of a ring, has a new power and a new responsibility. And is that going to go for good ends or ill ends? And I think you can keep following that metaphor through. And, it seems to be that, humankind throughout history dealing with new power, there's a temptation to good and a temptation to evil. And that's very much what's playing out in season.
Yeah. And we know from the text that Galadriel gains the gift of foresight. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a gift, but also perhaps a curse. Mm-hmm. Is that an interesting wrinkle?
That's the thing we play with. Yeah. Season two is she starts out these, we call them ring flashes, mm-hmm. in the production, but she starts to see these glimmers of things that might come to pass. But playing with the future is always dangerous because you don't know if by second guessing it, you're going to bring to pass the very thing that you were trying to prevent. You don't know how set in stone the future that you're seeing is. So it's perilous.
Yeah. But I think, that actually brings up a good point, which is that it's also about character, these rings. It's not just about, the fate of empires. Galadriel's on an arc that we know is going to lead her to be the wise lady in the wood. And she's very far from that when you meet her at the beginning of season one. Her putting on a ring that preserves and heals Middle Earth and encourages elven foresight and, elven sort of creative abilities and desire to protect and heal. Those are all things that are going to help heal and change her. Mm. And that's another part that's sort of playing out this season.
Fascinating. There's another big addition this season, of course, is Tom Bombadil, mm-hmm. Which I know, all Tolkien fans will have a mixture of excitement and trepidation and, seeing this character on screen for the first time. I mean, was that your reaction in choosing to bring him to season two?
We're always looking for, underexplored corners of the mythology. Mm. Tom Bombadil, having never been brought to the screen in this kind of spectacular fashion before, felt like a virgin territory in a way. The idea of finding an amazing actor like Rory Kinnear and having Tom Bombadil pop up in the most unexpected place in the deserts of Rune felt like, too tempting to pass up. Mm-hmm. What should we say about him?
He's a character who's so intriguing in that he's the oldest character in Middle Earth. As you remember, his first raindrop and the first acorn. Especially as we were thinking about our wizard character and the journey he's going on of self-discovery, it felt like, you needed someone like that who had that level of wisdom who could guide him through figuring out what it meant to be a wizard and how to control his powers and why he was supposed to be here. It served a narrative purpose. But then as we were actually going through the challenging task of actually bringing it to the screen, we tried to stick as close to the character as we could. I think a quarter of Bombadil's dialogue actually comes straight from the books themselves. Oh, wow. And then we also looked deeply into how Tolkien rendered his dialogue and found this sort of Anglo-Saxon verse form that he was writing in. And so we tried to adopt that where possible. And then with his costume, you know, like assiduously bright blue jacket is, and his boots are yellow, figuring out what that might look like in a runic context, you know, having the feather in his hat, and also having him sing and say, you know, his various rhymes. You know, so he has a very sort of childlike whimsical part to him, but then also finding that sort of deep, ancient, wise being at the center of it all. So it's a balancing act with Tom.
Yeah. We come to this property as fans first, and, you know, we're loving what Rory Kinnear has done to bring Tom Bombadil to life. We hope fans feel the same way.
Yeah. Because, you know, famously, I mean, he's quite a sort of passive character, and he's the character that I think, you know, Peter Jackson and Ralph Bakshi couldn't manage to bring to screen. Was it an interesting challenge, like making him dramatically?
I mean, it was undeniable. We felt compelled. You know, it would have been very hard to turn Tom down once he started knocking at our door, so to speak.
We've said, you know, in other places that he's an anti-dramatic character. You go to Tom and the full momentum of story stops in the books. And so understand why, if you were doing Fellowship of the Ring, you might say, okay, let's leapfrog over that in when you only have so many hours to do an adaptation. Yeah. You know, one of the things that we're really fortunate with in TV shows, we have a little bit more real estate to be able to play with. And we were also able to do something where we're not adapting that specific episode that is mentioned in, or that is dramatized in the books of Fellowship of the Ring. We're bringing Tom Bombadil in a different time in his life and a different time in his story arc. So we have a little bit more freedom to be able to have him impact the story in a slightly different way that ends up having a little bit more forward propulsion than if you were adapting the episode that you see in Fellowship of the Ring.
Just a little. He's such a trickster. You never know what he's after.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait. I mean, are there any other characters from the text that haven't been seen on the screen before that you'd like
Círdan?
To resurrect?
Yeah, we should talk about Círdan, played by the amazing, spectacular actor Ben Daniels. Círdan, you know, I think you glimpse him in Peter's films, Peter Jackson's films, but he's the oldest, wisest elf. He's the shipwright. He has this incredibly beautiful, tragic characterization in the books where he's constantly ferrying elves off to Valinor, off to, you know, elven, I guess, heaven.
Well, the Undying Lands.
The Undying Lands. Yeah. But he can never go himself. Mm. And there's something so heartbreaking and bittersweet about that idea. And, you know, again, looking for sources of wisdom in Middle-earth. In this case, it's Elrond, played by Rob Aramayo, going to him for counsel. You know, that was another place where it's just like, you know, we're reaping the rewards of the characters in those pages.
Yeah, yeah. And are you constantly referring to the texts through this process?
Yeah, every day.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, we would start each day of our writer's room with a quote from Tolkien. You know, we often will, it's like tuning the orchestra.
Yeah.
You settle into it for a minute and you get into that that space.
But you're also, when you're writing, I mean, literally, you know, you're hitting Control F to see if that word appears ever in the text. And if there's words that appear, you know, that aren't there, we'll strike them and replace them with something that feels more Tolkienian. Mm. We really think that granularly about it.
Yeah. And, you know, Tolkien obviously has a huge fan base. The season one had a huge reaction in every direction.
So lucky and so grateful. Yeah.
I mean, I know that you'd already written season two by the time season one came out, but I'm curious if that, like, you know, people have opinions on the internet, it turns out. Like, did that reaction color or shape your season two?
I mean, not particularly consciously. I mean, you read everything and then it all sort of goes into the mill and gets ground up, and, you know, who knows how it ultimately affects, you know, sort of, you know, what's coming out on the page. You know, but no, we try not to be overly swayed by any one voice.
Yeah. We're our own harshest critics, and you know, our job as we see it is to be the stewards of this property and to bring this show to the screen in the most spectacular fashion possible. And we want it to be better minute by minute, episode by episode, season by season. And you know, I think this season we had the benefit of having done it once before. And that brings a lot of institutional knowledge and hopefully some know-how and experience. And hopefully you feel that in the episodes and in the season. Hopefully there's a sort of authority and a confidence of knowing our lane now. Whereas season one, in some ways, like, you know, we were trying it for the first time. We all were. What does the second age feel like, look like? That was a process of discovery. And I think we have a stronger sense now of all of that. And we feel it in the episodes. Hopefully audiences do too.
Yeah. How was the process for season two then? I imagine the scale of it is increased.
Yeah. Season two is bigger. I mean, they're both season one ain't no slouch, but season two is more, just huge.
More creatures, bigger battle,
more action,
higher stakes.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, for you as showrunners, like, is it hard sometimes to keep a handle on everything? Like, do you
surprisingly no? You know,
we have each other. I mean, we've been working together for 25 years, and you know. I think we divide and conquer pretty well, and really trust each other. Especially after going through the process of making season one together, you know, we've sort of learned, you know, what parts of the production we each flourish in, and so there's just a lot of trust and a lot of communication.
You're building a pyramid every season, and how do you build a pyramid? One block at a time.
Mm. Yeah, and the difference with this season, of course, is you moved from New Zealand to the UK for your like production base. I mean. How was that in terms of British weather? Did that give you any?
No,
lots of cold nights and cold rainy nights in dark woods.
Yeah, the way the scheduling worked out, we shot through the fall and winter. So that was a challenge at times. But you know, we're on stages a lot. We're building. Yeah. I mean, you know, Casa Doom fills an entire stage. It's this massive set.
Yeah.
Linden is a massive set that fills a stage. Mm-hmm. But we did a lot of location work this season. We shot a lot in Great Windsor Park. We did some shooting around Kent. You know, we shot down in Spain in the Canary Islands, and that's all stuff we had access because we were here. You know, but in terms of the weather, I think it seeped in. Season two is a much darker season. As we've said, it's the Sauron season, and the sort of spookiness, mistiness, the clouds, the rain, the wind, Wuthering Heights vibe. I think, you know, adds a little something this season. And, you know, hopefully you're not thinking that you're in New Zealand versus the UK. Hopefully it all feels like Middle Earth. Yeah. But there is just a little bit of a subtle change this season that, you know, informs the work.
Yeah. And then how far ahead are you thinking? Presumably you have this whole story mapped out. Mm-hmm. Like how mapped out are you? Like
pretty mapped out.
I mean, we're always thinking sort of, you know, all the way ahead, and we're saying, how is this going to affect something next season, season after? For all 50 hours of the story. And so we're planting seeds that we'll be harvesting the fruit of two seasons down the road. And you know, Tolkien laid out the major milestones. And so we all say it's like a road trip. If you're starting in LA and want to go to New York, you sort of know, you know, you're going to stop in Denver and then, you know, maybe go to Nashville or, you know, whatever, and just make your way across the country. But we also leave room for some exploration as well, where there's characters you find have amazing chemistry in terms of the actors. Or there's a storyline you thought was going to be a small detour that ends up having, you know, giving more
You work with these incredible collaborators. Christian Milstead is our production designer. You know, he did a lot of the designs on Watchmen and then Willow. And he's this incredibly ambitious, incredible designer with a deep love of the texts. And, you know, he's constantly coming at us with, you know, fresh ideas. What if it was like this? Mm-hmm. You know, Charlotte Brandstrom, our producing director we mentioned earlier, you know, she has such a strong dramatic sense of what this should be. We have all these amazing actors. You know, Ben Walker turns out is a song and dance man. He's, you know, Juilliard trained. So we're like, well, maybe he should sing. You know, that wasn't part of the long-term plan. That's adapting to the situation on the ground. But, you know, so far, two seasons through, plans holding up. Even though, you know, you're always looking for taking advantage of what's happening on the day, what's happening on the month, what an actor can do. You know, Morbeth Clark, who plays Galadriel, who's just incredible. Her performance is amazing this season. You know, she can do anything. She can sing. She's a great comedian. Mm-hmm. So then you think about like, oh, we got to see another side of Galadriel. We love the action hero. We love the flinty heroine. But it'd be great if she could be a little wry and funny sometime too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you find a way to weave that in.
Yeah, but surely for you as writers, you must require a lot of patience. For there's certain like characters, their arc, their payoff won't come for years to come. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of like Isildur.
Isildur, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We know how that his story ends, but that might not be for years.
That's part of the fun of it is you say every single season, every single scene, how is this pushing him towards that ultimate tragic decision to take the ring? And you say, you know, if you watch a character like this go through different kinds of losses. Season one, it was all about he was sort of alienated from his homeland, and he felt like his homeland had changed and wasn't the Numenor that he, you know, had sort of idealized in his mind romantically. And season two is all sort of there's no place like home because he's stuck in Middle Earth, and he comes to really value what Numenor is by seeing what the rest of Middle Earth is.
There's little moments along the way. There's bricks in the wall. There's a moment I'll call out in episode three. Where he is in Mordor, he's stranded. He has no shoes. He has no weapons. All he has is his horse, Beric, much love. And he finds a body of one of his comrades in arms in a pool. He steals the boots and he steals the sword. And that's not something Isildur would have done season one. But it's a step along the way. Yeah. This kid's starting to cut corners.
And you also hear him talk about things that he's lost. He speaks about his mother. And you start to see how sort of loss becomes a theme in Isildur's life again and again. And if you know Legendarium, he's going to lose more people along the way. And how far do you push that character before he gets a chance at the One Ring? And he says, you know what? Not losing this. I'm keeping this one. I've earned it.
Fascinating. So where are we with season three then? Is that written?
We can't say anything. All we'll say is we're very, very excited and we're working.
Yep.
Okay. I'm intrigued. I can't wait.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. JD, Patrick, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Lovely speaking with you. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, that was Patrick McKay and JD Payne. And now let's go straight to our interview with Morfydd Clark and Sam Hazeldene, the elf and the orc. Quite a combination. And they were talking to our very own geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too, yeah. And hello, Sam. Nice to meet you.
Hello, nice to meet you.
So you two, I guess, in the show play kind of relations in that the orcs, you know, come from elven stock, right? So I guess you don't get to maybe spend so much time with each other on screen, at least by choice. So how has it been hanging out this time? Have you gotten to actually meet off screen at least before now?
But on screen, it's, you know, it's been very kind of this sort of tentative thing of it, because it's really weird if you're in Mordor with a bunch of orcs to suddenly have an elf in our midst, and nobody kind of knows quite how to react. Do we? Do we? Are we frightened of her? Or do we kill her? Eat her? What do we do?
I mean, you know? Bit of everything, maybe?
Something for everyone. Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah. It was really... visually really interesting seeing those two kind of worlds trying to coexist. Which neither of us probably wanted to do, but you know, forced to, you know, because of the threat of Sauron and his return.
It's also fun as well that different kind of characters and therefore different actors kind of own a certain domain.
You're in my house now.
Yeah, it was really fun. And it's kind of they are bound by that they've both been deceived. They've both made the same stupid mistake. But ultimately have nothing else
in common.
Their biggest error. So it's a weird, fraught relationship.
It is. But I think Adar does try to make you feel as welcome as possible with that delicious meal.
So what's it like, especially for Morfydd, like coming back for season two? Has this been a very different experience? Because I know season one, you were caught up in the pandemic. Like there were all sorts of restrictions on everything you could do. You know, you were stuck in a very beautiful place, but you were in New Zealand for a very long time. Did this feel like a different experience coming back and being closer to home and being maybe a little bit more free to roam around between scenes?
It still seems as kind of magical to me as kind of Middle Earth itself that I was in New Zealand for 2 years filming the first season. And kind of coming back to it in Britain, it was great to kind of be near kind of lots of my family and things, but it really did just kind of make it even more heightened that I kind of spent any time in New Zealand. It was just... I mean, it's one of those things, it's like, I can't believe the roll of the dice in my life led me to being there. And I think everyone who was there, sorry, Sam.
Sorry, just carry on.
Yeah. Everyone who was there, our characters and our kind of understanding of this world was so influenced by being in New Zealand, just kind of, Aotearoa is just the most beautiful, inspiring place and we were so welcome there. But also we were working with lots of people who'd kind of been in Middle Earth for years and years. And so... in all the seasons to come, our time in New Zealand will be really precious.
Yeah, absolutely. And Sam, you're obviously coming into this, but I think you knew when the last season came out that you were sort of coming in, I guess. So you know, how's it been taking over that character and kind of shaping him and developing him? Because we'd only really caught glimpses last season, it feels like.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I only saw Joseph Zadar when everybody else did when the series came out. So, but I had known about taking over the role for a few months before that. So, but it's so kind of, it's such an amazing character and I really like what he did. And so it's great to be kind of taking it from there and, introducing him to the new circumstances that he's, you know, that happened to him in season two. Yeah. So it was just a pleasure, really.
Yeah. His start of the season, he's kind of achieved his big aim, right? He's created this homeworld. So exactly I guess everything is smooth sailing from then on.
It should be, yeah, until Halbrand reappears and can't shake this feeling that there's something up with this Halbrand guy. Mm. And yeah, everything's thrown completely into chaos again. Yeah.
Who would have thought? Who would have thought? so tell me about, you know, making this season. What was the most sort of holy shit, I'm in Middle Earth kind of moment that you experienced this season? Did you have a favorite set or a favorite scene that you can talk about?
I think for me, I found that first episode kind of in Linden, where we have, and I think both of our kind of best moments are probably ones where there's absolutely loads of supporting actors.
Yeah.
I mean, you feel so lucky when you're kind of, you feel that you can't turn anywhere and not see Middle Earth. And I was surrounded by elves in this incredible set of Linden. And we were also kind of, as the kind of person who's just obsessed with Middle Earth and Tolkien, we were doing one of the moments that we'd been looking forward to, mm-hmm. that the elves were getting their rings. And so that was super exciting. We were all kind of nerding out about it. Mm-hmm.
For me, I think in the Battle of Eregion, which I can talk about, can't I? Because we already know about that. There was a day on that. Well, there were lots of days on it, but there was one thing with these huge, what do you call them? The things that throw.
Trebuchets.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And we were there and I'm standing in this place and we're doing a rehearsal for the thing. And then I get called over to. Because, you know, there's technical things where you have to go and look at the monitor to work out what's going on. If you've got to do a sort of technical thing of where you need to get to here and here by this point. And so I went and looked on the monitor and I was like, what's that? And he said, that's it. That's the shot. I was like, oh my God. I thought it was a film. The sets, it's just so incredible. Yeah. But when you're in the middle of it, you don't really see, you know, you're not seeing exactly what the camera's seeing. You're seeing a tiny part of it. And, you know, like hundreds of orcs and, you know, these real life-size, massive trebuchets. Thank you for trebuchets. And and it was just, it's incredible.
I think on that, something I hadn't kind of expected from being in a fantasy is that kind of they built these incredible trebuchets that, like, they're obviously in a fantasy world, but they looked back at lots of historical things of how to build them. And lots of the costumes also, I hadn't realized how much kind of craft is being sustained through film and not just historical drama but also fantasy, because obviously fantasy goes back and picks out all the most kind of interesting and beautiful parts of history and kind of making. And so when you're surrounded by craft and some of it quite ancient craft, that always makes me really excited.
I mean, it's so intricate and beautiful, some of the design.
I did want to ask though about the sort of the action elements, because I was reading the Empire interview that you did more than a little while ago, and you were talking about having learned archery for this season. And I'm guessing, Sam, that you had a certain amount of, you know, sword fighting and just laying about you to do as well. So how was all of that?
Well, I read that about you being really good at archery.
Yeah.
And I felt really competitive because I had this thing called the Country Cup with my friends where we just play loads of games for a whole weekend, and archery is one of them. And I currently own the archery cup.
Oh, do you? To be honest, the target that I was going for was pretty close.
Really?
So I don't know if I've really been. I watched the Olympics. I was like, whoa, that's
quite far
really
away.
Far away. Yeah, what type of fighting are you up to?
On this?
Yeah.
Well, I don't really want to give too much away, but I do fight with some other main characters. So it's everything to play for.
Yeah. I mean, those are the parts that it's just like, you feel so lucky that you're getting taught all this stuff.
Yeah.
And also, I don't know about you, but I never liked being taught stuff as a child. No. And I feel really lucky that as an adult, I've been given this opportunity to like learn, because I didn't want to learn when I was being taught. And now it's like,
yeah, that's one of my favorite things on acting jobs, is when you learn a new skill or, you know, develop something. And, you know, not that we learned the languages, but we learned some of Elvish and black speech and so on. But yeah, the practical things of writing stuff can be really.
Trebuchet use, I assume.
I now own 3 trebuchets.
Well, tell me about the languages as well, because I know, I mean, Morfydd, we talked in the past about, you know, Welsh essentially did feed into Elvish and the kind of relationships there. So I think that's helped a little bit for you. But Sam, did you have any languages that helped at all with the black speech?
No, I don't think there are any languages that help black speech. But, you know, but I loved doing it. It's a really good... you know, you're sort of in at the deep end with it, and it's so much a part of the, not just the world, but the character specifically. Mm-hmm. So I did keep asking for more black speech whenever there was an opportunity to, I was thinking, well, this would be better if it was in black speech because of who it was I was talking to or what I was saying, you know. But I do feel that you're at an advantage with them being Welsh.
Nice.
Yeah.
Calm down.
You're like, just in general in life, yes.
Correct. In general, yeah. Being Welsh is so great. Yeah. I loved speaking Elvish, you know, Sindarin and Quenya. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. Awesome. So so tell me about, I feel like both of you get to kind of develop your respective cultures a little bit this time. You know, I've only seen a few episodes, but, you know, we have Galadriel coming back and going, good news and bad news, guys. You know, good news, I've got a potential weapon for us. Bad news, I met a guy. And meanwhile, Adar is kind of showing showing orc culture, which is not really something we've come across at all before. So you've both got a lot of kind of thorny issues to deal with and kind of develop this season.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I think so. It's, you know, we're not straightforward characters, are we?
Yeah. And I think also... the orcs aren't aligned, the elves aren't aligned, like, within their individual camps. Mm. And so Sauron really he's done a pretty good job. Everybody is kind of separate and weak because of it. And it is really fun. I think Galadriel was quite kind of separate from her elfness in the last season. It's been really fun to kind of be amongst the elves. Mm. Yeah, and then Adar is just kind of fascinating because he is both, and he's kind of he's a sad mirror.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was really interested in what it is about what Adar was unhappy about when he was once an elf that made him want to kind of do this deal to be something else. That, you know, he was obviously someone with. Could he say he was someone with a chip on his shoulder? He was. Mm. He wanted more power. He wanted other things. You know, who knows? And maybe we'll find some of that out this season. But you know, and that the deal was bad, of course, because he was deceived. So if he had that choice again, that I think he would probably have remained an elf. And so he has that about him, that there is a sort of a very strange. Hatred / respect for the elves and for wanting to be included. There's a line about they'll never treat you with anything but they'll never look upon you with anything but there's something of disgust. I can't remember what it is, and I think it's something that really touches him deeply. Yeah. And it's difficult.
And Galadriel, you know, after being sort of obsessed with the threat of Sauron, now comes back with the word that good news, I was right. Bad news, I helped him. Sorry, guys. It's a difficult position for her.
Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm a pessimist. I'm more just super worried. And it's always this weird thing, you know, when the thing you've been like, I'm worried this bad thing could happen, because you're like, I was right. In the worst possible way. And Galadriel's kind of experiencing that. But I think also kind of she doesn't have any sense of who she is anymore. She was so certain. And it's something also that I quite like about it, because I think there's something that I could relate to, and I think we can all relate to. It's terrible to have misjudged someone and thought that they were kinder or gentler or just different to who they were.
Authentic.
Yeah. And those are moments that do change you. And it was kind of interesting to kind of explore that on an elf level, because an elf being changed is kind of will change the world for thousands of years to come. I'm quite obsessed with the idea of consequence, and that the idea of consequence for the elves is so much more intense.
So what do you think will be the takeaway from this season? Do you think people are going to start looking askance at gifts of jewellery?
Yeah. They should do. You should always be suspicious of that.
The giver of gifts.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I love about this season is I think that there's a lot of bravery.
Mm.
And that's something that I've always loved about Tolkien's world. It's something I also love about, this is from a Philip Pullman book, but what is it that Yorick Bernerson says when he's like, Lyra's like, "You're never afraid, are you?" And he's like, "When I am afraid, I will conquer my fear."
Mm.
And I think there's quite a lot of that in this, and that's something I love to see.
People have to overcome their
lack
of belief in themselves and just do instead of question.
Yeah.
Just look at Adar in season one. He overcame all sorts of lack of belief and just did the job, you know? What a guy.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much. Really looking forward to seeing the rest of the season. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Morfydd Clark and Sam Hazeldine, and that is it for our preview special dedicated to The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Lots to look forward to over the next few weeks, folks, starting with those three episodes which drop on Thursday, August 29th. Hang on, isn't that Judgment Day? I'm sure it's nothing to worry about. Anyway, there will be an Empire supporter special at the end of the season, so keep them peeled for that. And if you want even more LOTR, then check out the next episode of Pilot TV, that's right, our sister podcast, which will have an interview with Charles Edwards, who plays the elvish craftsman or crafts elf Celebrimbor, and Charlie Vickers, aka Sauron. Ugh. Right, that's it for me. I'd do a longer outro, but it's Sauron the voice. Sauron the voice. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.